Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to In Plain English. I am your host, Jamie Moffa, and this is the 8th episode of SFN Shorts, where I interviewed early career researchers at the Society for Neuroscience conference last year in Washington, D.C. This is the second to last episode of SFN Shorts, and the next one will be airing next week on Tuesday, February 27th. So please stay tuned for that, and please let me know if you have enjoyed these SFN Shorts. They've been a lot of fun to put together, and I actually have quite a bit of conference travel coming up in the next year, so I'll have a lot of opportunity to interview more scientists at these conferences if this is something you all enjoyed. So please leave a review or a message or shoot me an email and let me know if that's something that you enjoyed. The week after that, we will have another full-length episode. This one will be more in my wheelhouse, and it'll be about neuroscience and opioids and breathing. So please stay tuned for that as well. That is going to be on Tuesday, March 5th. And without further ado, let's get into the episode. Our first interview for this episode was with Allie Sinclair, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Her research focuses on learning, memory, and motivation, and how our motivational state and kind of state of mind affects how we learn. Her presentation gets into a little bit of complicated jargon with some different areas of the brain, but the main takeaway was that, first of all, people learn and remember things differently if they are in a mindset of, you know, needing to get, you know, the most out of a situation possible right off the bat, versus if they are in a situation where they need to slow down and evaluate and really like take stock of all of their potential choices in a moment. The corollary to that is that there are different brain regions which are more active when you are in the first kind of situation versus the second.
So first, can you just introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Allie Sinclair. I'm currently a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, but today I'm sharing some work that I did in my PhD at Duke with Allison Adcock.
Cool. Awesome.
All right. So jumping right into it, in this project, we were interested in how motivation influences how we make choices and what we remember later on. We wanted to test some predictions from a theoretical framework that talks about two different kinds of motivational states. Imperative motivation is like urgent mode. It helps us address urgent threats or goals like avoiding danger or winning a competition. But it leads to a kind of tunnel vision, so it narrows the focus of attention and memory. And in the brain, it's associated with amygdala and medial temporal lobe systems and noradrenergic modulation. Conversely, interrogative motivation is like explore mode. It helps us be curious, discover and explore, find rewards, and plan for the future. It's linked to a broader focus for attention and memory, and in the brain, it's associated with VTA and hippocampal systems and dopaminergic modulation. But the studies that have informed this theoretical framework have focused on contrasting threats and rewards. We were interested in whether we could test these predictions in the same task while holding the incentives constant. So to do that, we varied the cover stories that we showed before a task. In the imperative group, we said, imagine that you're a master thief executing a heist at an art museum. Steal as much valuable art as you can before you run out of time. So we're really emphasizing these urgent salient goals. In the interrogative group, we tweaked this story. So we said, imagine that you're planning a heist and scouting the museum for this future heist. After reading one of these two cover stories, participants did the exact same reinforcement learning task. On each trial, they saw four colored doors representing different rooms of the museum. They could choose a door to sample one trial unique painting from that room and see the value associated with the painting. The points that they earned in this task by finding valuable paintings were converted into a bonus payment that they got later on. And this process repeated for 100 trials, so they saw new paintings every time, and the value associated with each door slowly drifted over time to encourage ongoing learning. The next day, we brought them back for a surprise memory test. So we showed them some paintings, had them judge if they were old or new, and recall how much that painting had been worth the day before. And finally, they actually got paid. So I want to emphasize that the only difference between the two conditions is that story that they imagined at the very beginning. Everyone has the same understanding that they earn their bonus by getting points in this task, and they don't get it until the very end. That's the same across conditions. We used computational modeling to look at reinforcement learning across our two groups, and I won't go into the details of model construction right now, but I'm happy to take questions about it later. So in brief, we're interested in comparing these two groups in terms of the choices they make, what they remember later, and what's going on in the brain. So looking first at task performance, we replicated our prior behavioral findings showing a trade-off where the imperative group earns more points during the reinforcement learning task, and they also make more optimal choices, meaning that they're more likely to choose objectively the best door in terms of what we know is the underlying reward value. But then the next day, the interrogative group has better memory for the paintings that they encountered. We also looked at different kinds of choices that people could make, and we used outputs from our reinforcement learning model to classify trial by trial choices. We called a choice exploitation if they chose the door with the highest estimated value, so they're trying to earn more money. We called a choice directed exploration if they chose the door with the highest estimated uncertainty, so they're trying to learn more about the options that they're less sure about. And we called it random exploration if they chose one of the other two doors that was neither the best in terms of money nor in terms of uncertainty. And again, we show a trade-off where the imperative group engages in more exploitation, whereas the interrogative group engages in more directed exploration. Finally, we looked at learning rate, which is a parameter from our reinforcement learning model that governs how sensitive you are to prediction error. And we found a higher learning rate in the imperative group, meaning that these participants were more likely to adjust their choices in response to the feedback that they were getting. Next, looking at our brain results. First, in the choice phase, we're looking at the part where they're looking at the four doors and making their decision. And if we look across our entire sample at what's going on in the brain during choice, we see activation in regions like the VMPFC, dorsal striatum, cingulate cortex, and insula. But we were interested in comparing activation in a few ROIs across our two groups. So first, looking at the VMPFC, we looked at representations of uncertainty. So this is a trial-by-trial parametric modulator where we take the value of uncertainty associated with whatever door the participant ultimately ends up choosing on that trial. And we found that participants in the interrogative group showed stronger representations of uncertainty in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which nicely maps onto that behavioral finding where they were more likely to choose to resolve uncertainty. Next, we look at the dorsal striatum, and we show that in the imperative group, more activation in the dorsal striatum was associated with individual differences in how much they wanted to make exploitative choices to maximize reward. Finally, we looked at the feedback phase. So this is when they're looking at the painting and the value associated with it. In our entire sample, we first looked at the contrast of remembered over forgotten trials. So this is predicting brain activation during reinforcement learning, whether or not they're going to remember that painting the next day. And we find activation in the hippocampus, along the ventral visual stream, in the amygdala, and other regions like the medial prefrontal cortex. But we wanted to test predictions from our theoretical framework about the amygdala and the ventral tegmental area between our two groups. So first, subsetting this map up here, we want to see, even when they're remembering a painting, are there different routes to memory formation that depend on your motivational state? And in line with our predictions, we found that in the imperative group, more activation in the amygdala was predicting subsequent memory, but not in the interrogative group. Likewise, we looked at the VTA, and we found that in the interrogative group, they had stronger representations of reward during encoding relative to the imperative group. So to sum up our findings, we replicated our prior behavioral work showing this trade-off, where imperative motivation enhances short-term reward learning and drives you towards exploitation. And in the brain, it's activating the VMPFC, less so for uncertainty, and more so in the dorsal striatum, predicting exploitative choices. Conversely, in the interrogative group, we're seeing that they have better memory the next day, and during learning, they're strategically resolving uncertainty with this directed exploration. In the brain, we see that they have stronger representations of uncertainty in VMPFC and more representations of reward in VTA during encoding. So to sum up, these different motivational states have different pros and cons, and we show that it shifts the balance between these neural systems for short-term decisions and longer-term learning. If you want to know more about it, you can check out our behavioral paper down here. It came out a couple months ago in PNAS. We talk about two prior samples also showing this trade-off in choices and memory. And also stay tuned. We finished scanning about 2 weeks ago. So this is hot off the press. This is our first pass ROI analyses. There's a lot more we want to do with like functional connectivity and multivariate analyses. So stay tuned for more.
Here, another attendee at the poster asked why memory was enhanced for the interrogative group or the group that was told to plan a heist rather than act as though they are actively conducting a heist.
Yeah. So basically, in the interrogative group, we expect better memory, particularly for associative memory. In this case, the paintings are incidental. They're associated with reward. So that's why we expected that they would have better memory for those paintings. Under these conditions, we expect that VTA is modulating hippocampus, and that is enhancing plasticity and improving their memory, especially for that like sort of rich associative information in the future. So that was one of the key predictions that we wanted to test with this paradigm.
Here, another attendee asked whether they looked at the relationship between the trial by trial uncertainty of the paintings and subsequent memory. So basically, if a participant was more uncertain about the value of the painting when they were exploring the room, would they remember the painting better or not on the next day?
Great question. Yeah. In our prior behavioral papers, we did look at that and I believe did not find any significant effects of uncertainty on memory. But we also intend to do that here. And I think that might be promising if we're incorporating these neural representations of uncertainty and seeing how that relates to memory.
They asked a follow-up question, which was how were the researchers determining the participants' uncertainty about the value of the paintings?
In this model currently, it's actually very straightforward. It's just how long has it been since you checked on this door? Because everyone knows that the values are drifting over time. So if you haven't tried the red door in like 25 trials, you should be not very confident about what the value actually is. However, there is another way that we've also tried modeling it with our prior behavioral work, which is a Bayesian model where it accounts for the variance of your like distribution of prior observations about that door. So how noisy is that set of observations that you have? And we find the same sort of effects in terms of directed exploration if we use that value of uncertainty instead.
Another follow-up question clarifying the tasks that participants were asked to do on the second day of the experiment.
Yeah, so we first did recognition. We had the 100 old images and 100 new images as well. We also had them recall the value associated with the painting and also try to remember which door the painting was associated with. In the prior behavioral work where we had more power and a lot more people, we found some interesting effects where participants in the interrogative group were also better at recalling the value associated with the painting, not only the painting itself. We also found a cool effect where reward is enhancing memory overall. So high-value paintings more likely to be remembered, not surprising, but only in the interrogative group. So in the interrogative group, they have this effect, but we actually break it in the imperative group. So not only do they have worse memory, they're not benefiting from that boost of reward, which is cool. We're not seeing that significant here, but it is a much smaller sample. But with that said, this effect, I think, here really nicely maps onto that in the behavioral sample before.
So why do you think that is? Because I think that like maybe the imperative, like urgent group would be more sensitive to reward because they're exploiting it so much.
Yeah, so one might think that, right? Because they're attending more to reward. But from this theoretical framework, we would predict that they would have a worse memory for the associative information. So if it were, say, something that was directly goal or threat relevant, we would expect heightened memory in the imperative group for that detail, but not the stuff around it. But in this case, because we're targeting this like incidental memory for the paintings that are associated with reward, we would expect that that associative link would actually be disrupted in the imperative group, and that's what we see.
Okay. They were just more remembering which door at what time was like.
Yes. Yeah, so the direct link would be door to value, but of course that's hard to assess later because the value is constantly changing.
Right, yeah.
Oh, you were also asking about like scene door. Performance is terrible. They're actually like well below chance. I think they're using a heuristic and we're not really sure what it is, but in both groups it's very poor. It's like 12% accuracy when chance would be 25%. So
incredible. So you should actually pick one of the doors that you thought it was not from and you'd have a better chance.
Yes. I'm guessing they have their bias by like some favorite door, maybe what was best at the beginning or best at the end, and they just want to say everything's associated with that.
That was my question. I'm like, do you look at like either the first or the last door that was like luckiest or whatever? And then like
we have not looked at that yet, but I would suspect that that's what's biasing their choices there. Yeah.
I already asked a lot of my questions the first time I was here.
Yeah.
My question this time is, do you want water?
That would be awesome. Okay. Would you mind refilling this? I've been rationing the last sip.
In this interview, I spoke with Victoria Chavez, a researcher at Columbia University, about the relationship between COVID-19 infection during pregnancy, maternal cognition, and infant cognition.
So I work at the COVID-19 Mother-Baby Outcome Initiative, the COMB Initiative at Columbia. And we're a cohort that we started recruiting moms prenatally when they were in the beginning of the pandemic. So now our cohort is almost 3 years old, and we have all of this data that we can analyze for different things. So my interest for this was to look at maternal cognition and how maternal cognition influences infant cognition, as well as the influence of COVID on maternal cognition itself and by itself. Another thing that I'm really interested in is maternal sensitivity. I'm not sure if you're familiar with maternal sensitivity, but it's basically a dyadic synchrony and how the mom is adequately responsive to the baby. And the way that we do this is by, at 4 months, we do a video visit with the moms. And during the diaper changing paradigm, where we just ask the mom to change her baby's diaper like she normally would, we can code for behaviors that would take place in a normal interaction, in a normal diaper change. And that's how we code maternal sensitivity. So for my results, maternal cognitive scores in the MNAR, which is the verbal fluency test, was positively and significantly associated with communication and fine motor scores in infant development. Which makes sense, since MNAR is measuring verbal fluency, it is impacting on the infant's communication at 18 months. That makes perfect sense. For fine motor, that's when it got a bit tricky for me, but what I came up with, and it's just my hypothesis, is that fine motor tasks require further explanation and more explanation than, let's say, a gross motor test. So if I were to tell a kid to just jump versus can you pincer grasp a pencil or can you pinch this little object and put it in a tiny bowl, that requires more of verbal explanation, which is why, perhaps why the MNAR is significantly predicting the infant fine motor scores. In terms of COVID itself, COVID status pre-pregnancy or during pregnancy was associated, or COVID status was associated with the lower score in the MNAR. So moms that were COVID positive scored lower on the MNAR. This is reported in the literature pretty clearly as one of the long-lasting effects of COVID, so that was kind of expected, and it happens. Last two things is that when I did in an adjusted model for all of these, only fine motor gave me a significant hit, and it was gestational age as a significant predictor of fine motor scores, which also makes sense. Gestational age is something that we control for in everything in our study, just because it differentiates between premature versus non-premature babies and how that can impact their infant outcomes at different ages. So that was cool, and again, it made sense. And lastly, for maternal sensitivity, I had a smaller sample than my everyone that I was looking at, and that's because some moms just didn't complete the video visit. So this is more of an exploratory analysis. But higher maternal sensitivity was associated with lower fine motor scores. And our rationale for this, my PI, she's very keen about this, and what she came up with, and I totally agree with, is that the whole theory of helicopter parenting and extreme coddling of babies, maybe not letting them perform tasks that would be more complicated or harder, or just maybe you just don't think your baby can do it, so you just say no when maybe they could do it. So this, for we need more experiment and more data for this, but again, just exploratory and just connecting to something that has been debated, like helicopter parenting and excessive coddling of infants.
That's really interesting. So when you were measuring the AMNAR cognitive, that's just measuring the like mother's cognitive yes. ability.
Yes, so it's a verbal fluency test where I just ask the mom to read 45 words. Some words, the words are harder. It's like imbroglio and syncope and stuff like this. But it basically measures how well you can make up a sound if you were to be given a set of words. And that's how we score it.
And so, like, this was just mothers that had COVID during pregnancy, not like, so like some of these other people could have had COVID during, not during pregnancy.
Yeah, so our recruitment in this COVID data specifically and the groups of 65 exposed versus 18 unexposed is specifically during pregnancy. Okay. So those moms either had COVID during pregnancy or didn't.
Okay.
However, we are going through a data cleaning in our study, just so we can have more information about that. So moms that had COVID, for example, 5 times and like 3 times were after they were pregnant, when it happened and so on, because that could definitely impact their cognitive scores different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So then that, like, because of the relationship between the cognitive scores and the children's communication scores and their fine motor scores, so like this effect of having COVID during pregnancy could also affect like the like children's development.
So that was the first analysis that I did was COVID directly to infant development. So I did a COVID just like this. It was like COVID to fine motor, COVID to communication, and I got nothing from that. However, as you're saying, if the MNART is predicting my ISQ communication and my COVID status is predicting my MNART, there's definitely an indirect relationship going on that does require more analysis, but that's exactly where my brain went when I had this done.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really interesting and important study.
Yeah, cool. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for going through that and recording yourself.
Of course, of course.
Our last interview for this episode features Jerry Lee, a researcher at the University of Toronto in Canada. His research focuses on the treatment of trigeminal neuralgia, a condition that causes facial pain. And specifically, he was investigating the relationship between a surgical treatment for trigeminal neuralgia and the volume of an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is known to be reduced in trigeminal neuralgia patients.
So can you start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Jerry. I'm a researcher at Toronto Western Hospital. We're located in Toronto, Canada, and we have the largest clinic for treating patients with a chronic facial pain condition called trigeminal neuralgia. So in these patients that we see in our clinic, we can see that they have issues with their brain's gray matter, or there's a region of the brain called the hippocampus, which is responsible for memory. And in those patients with trigeminal neuralgia, or TN, we see that they have decreased hippocampal volume.
Okay.
And then, fortunately for these patients, they can undergo a surgery called microvascular decompression. And this has a success rate of 90% in terms of relieving their pain almost immediately after surgery.
Wow.
And so that makes this platform, allows us to study how the brain recovers from chronic pain.
And is that like a brain surgery? They have to go into the brain to do this?
Or? Yeah. So it's an open brain surgery. Wow. So they open your brain kind of close to the back of your ear. And then they'll move your cerebellum, like the part of your brain that controls like your movement generally. And then they'll go in and clear the issue there.
Wow, that is crazy. I did not know that was a thing, but yeah.
So previously our lab has found that after our TN patients underwent a different kind of pain relieving surgery, their hippocampus volume normalized, or it re-increased back to a level comparable to people who are healthy without chronic pain.
Okay.
And so we wanted to look into that further because we don't know what effects age and sex have on that normalization process. And so what we did was we took 50 patients who had TN, and then we age and sex matched them to 50 healthy controls. And then we took MRI scans of their brain. So we looked at them before surgery and then 6 months after the surgery. And then we grouped them into people who responded to the surgery or who had significant amount of pain relief from the surgery. And then we ran those brain scans through a program called FreeSurfer, which allowed us to do something called hippocampal segmentation, which basically just divides out the hippocampus from the brain, and it gives us like the volumes of different subregions in the hippocampus.
Okay.
And then we analyzed that using two statistical programs called R and Python. And then moving on to the results, we first had to deal with an issue of how do we compare people with different head sizes equivalently.
Right, yeah.
And this is called normalization. So we found one variable of the brain called the subcortical gray matter volume. This was used to do something called normalizing the volume so that we could have equivalent comparisons between all of our patients.
Right, because you don't want to like accidentally just be measuring how big somebody's brain is,
exactly,
as opposed to like specifically the effect on the hippocampus.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. So we use that in something called a generalized linear model, which is just a mathematical equation that basically allows you to do equivalence comparison tests. And so Just like many other studies before us, we found that the males had larger hippocampi than the females, both before and after the surgery, which is just a regular finding. But more notably, we found that in females 50 years and younger, they had significant normalization or increase in their hippocampal volume after the surgery. After that, we also divided our patients into male and female with either left or right-sided facial pain.
Okay.
And in females who had right-sided facial pain, we saw that they had normalization of the left hemisphere regions of their hippocampus.
Okay, but not in the other way around.
Yeah, not in the other way around.
Okay, why do you think that is?
There are potentially a couple reasons. So one of them could be that perhaps like in your brain, when you, the way your brain like senses feelings in your face is like the left side of the brain generally senses the right side of your face and then vice versa.
Yeah.
So we're thinking that potentially maybe if there's like stronger connections between the right and the left, right side of your face and the left side of your brain, then potentially there's more of a noticeable effect on the hippocampus. And over time, just so much stress and so much pain eventually causes the hippocampus to decrease in volume and potentially like cell death is occurring. Yeah, and then that's probably the biggest reason that we could think of.
And so that was in females with
right-sided facial
pain. What happened with the males?
So the males, actually, we weren't able to find any significant effects.
Huh.
Yeah.
And does that track with, like, do females have a better outcome from this surgery than males, or is it kind of, like, similar?
So we also, in a previous study, found that after surgery, females also, we calculated something called the brain age of patients. And we also found that females with TN had a larger brain age than the males.
Okay.
And after the surgery, that brain age decreased and it became closer to their actual age.
Okay.
So it does track with previous findings, and I can explain why we think that in a little bit.
Yeah.
So following up on those results, we also looked at, we wanted to see if females had their hippocampus return back to normal volumes more or less, depending on how old they were. So we looked at the females 50 years and younger, and we saw that as they got closer to 50, the degree of hippocampal normalization that occurred decreased. So the younger they were, the more their hippocampus went back to normal levels.
Okay, and do you think that's just because younger people have more like brain plasticity?
Yeah, so there's potentially a lot of reasons, but I think just intuitively, like the younger you are, the more protected your body is from just general like bad health effects.
Right.
So potentially, yeah.
Did you kind of normalize this by how long they've had the trigeminal neuralgia?
Yeah, so we didn't do that because previous studies have found that there's actually like no correlations between any of the other variables that you can look at for these patients, like degree or intensity of pain. Okay. So we didn't normalize with those.
Okay, got it. So like you already know like the how long you've had it isn't really that as much of a factor as how old you are.
Exactly.
Okay, that's interesting.
And then, and so none of these effects were seen in any of the males. And yeah, so our major kind of conclusions from this are just that we saw a key like inflection point, we call it, at the age of 50, where females beyond that age, we weren't able to observe this normalizing process. And then, or this normalizing effect. And we, along with that, we also found that in females with right-sided pain, they had more normalizing in their left hemisphere regions of the hippocampus. And then so hippocampal volume can be important in helping to predict surgical outcomes for TN patients.
Okay.
And then we also saw that as females got closer to the age of 50, they had less normalizing of their hippocampus. And we recently published a paper that showed that females with TN take almost twice as long than men or males with TN to receive surgical treatment. And so this just kind of goes towards a greater body of support for advocating for more equitable healthcare treatment for females.
Especially because it seems like, you know, they're the ones in terms of like the hippocampal volume that are like benefiting the most from this.
Yeah, exactly. So they're kind of like a more vulnerable subpopulation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super interesting. So I guess like kind of getting back to that sex difference, like why do you think that's happening?
Yeah, so I guess the easiest idea that you could think of here, or the most intuitive, is just that when females get to the age of 50 or around there, they go through menopause. And we know that the hippocampus also has estrogen receptors found throughout it and on it. So as estrogen levels decrease as women go through menopause, then likely they lose that estrogen signaling on the hippocampus, which potentially could play some sort of maintenance role in its health. Yeah.
And so do you think the like volume normalization, do you think that's driven primarily by neurons, or do you think it's driven primarily by like glia and like structures that are around the neurons?
Yeah, I can't say for sure. It seems there's not as much research on glial cells at the moment in general for the brain. So I would think that it's probably a combination of both.
Right, yeah. No, that's really cool. That's super interesting.
Okay, yeah, no, thank you for coming and for asking questions.
Yeah, and thank you for agreeing to be recorded.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And that will do it for this episode of SFN Shorts. Once again, our featured interviewees were Ali Sinclair, Victoria Chavez, and Jerry Lee. You can follow along with their papers on the website at inplainenglishpod.org. We will be back next week on February 27th with our last episode of SFN Shorts, so stay tuned for that. The week afterwards, we will be having a full-length episode as normal. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.